Thank you, Larry Olmsted. That was marvelous. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me begin by asking you this. We know, as you have said, that food fraud is a growing problem. In Britain, for example, families are finding that it's up to $1.17 billion a year nationwide. And the British have their National Food Crime Unit. My question is, do we have something here in the United States that would be equal to the British National Food Crime Unit?
We have something similar, not quite equal. In my book, I describe the Food Crime Unit as a real-life NCIS, all those shows, but for food. And they do a lot of testing, and they do a great job. In the U.S., we have something called the Food Fraud Institute, which is at Michigan State University. They do a lot of the similar testing, but they are not a government entity, so they have no enforcement capability. But they reveal a lot of these scams.
So my next question is, what is the good news? We first would love to know what the most recent scandal is in food, and also, what's the good news about food scandals?
All right, I'll start with the good news, which is, and there have just been steps towards progress. I look at it as this light at the end of a very long tunnel that's always getting a little bit closer. And because of a lot of this is media attention, and it sounds trite to say, you know, write your congressman, but when people are upset is when things change, and that's why we have an organic standard in this country, because in the 1990s, people got really upset with the fake labeling of organic food and complained enough, and they defined it. And when President Obama was in office, he created a presidential task force to combat seafood fraud, which is still in existence, hasn't done that much, but it's making some slight progress. It's a big problem. Congress just recently ordered the FDA to step up inspection of olive oil, and a large part of that was the high-profile 60 Minutes segment that was done on olive oil fraud. So there's a lot of these little improvements, and the one, when my book came out in paperback, I had to write a new little addendum to the end on some of the things that changed, and because I talk about it a lot, I talked about the San Marzano tomatoes. Like a lot of products from the rest of the world that I talk about in my book, things like champagne, it's a geographically designated product that's supposed to only come from this one place but is not protected in the U.S. And there was a major producer in California that for years has been selling these cans labeled San Marzano tomatoes with Italian-y looking labels. And they're in every major supermarket in America. And they voluntarily decided, between the time my book came out in hardcover and paperback, to rename their tomato the San Americano instead of the San Marzano. And it's a very small thing, but for me, it's a huge emotional win. Oh, and then you wanted bad news. the most recent sort of scandal that I've seen, there's been a lot about honey in the news lately, but that's not really a new scandal. That's one of the most traditionally adulterated products. The new one is organics. I mentioned it being a good thing to look for the organic standard, but I just recently did an episode of the Dr. Oz show where we talked about this new organic issue, which is the importation of organic products mainly for animal feed, like soybeans and corn, that are not organic. And what the problem with that is these are being imported specifically to be sold to organic ranchers. So now that means those chickens, those cows, or the cattle that eat these feeds are no longer organic, and it's not a matter of the ranchers trying to stick it to us, it's a matter of the ranchers being deceived by buying what is supposed to be USDA certified organic. So that's a problem that's flown a little bit under the radar because it mainly is an industrial or commercial problem, not really a consumer facing problem, but it eventually affects what you buy at the supermarket.
This one came from several people. Are you in favor of labeling GMO food?
That's fun. I get that every time. I gave a lot of thought about whether or not to address GMOs in my book, and the reason I decided not to was, well, first of all, it was 2 years ago, so it was a little bit less of a hot-button issue than it is now, but also most of my work addresses things that are mislabeled or other than what they do. And since there was no laws, or especially when I wrote the book at all, about labeling GMOs, there was no real issue in terms of producers fooling you. you know, a lot of foods have GMO products in them, but they weren't claiming that they didn't. And it's a really tricky issue because there are definitely GMO products that I am opposed to, like the farm salmon that's twice as big as the other salmon that poses kind of ecosystem concerns. But most scientists believe, and doctors, and I'm neither, believe that most GMO crops are not dangerous to people, and genetic modification is something that farming and agriculture has always done. They just didn't do it in the laboratory. They did it through crossbreeding, and I was looking at, like, I have a golden retriever, and I love my dog, but golden retrievers didn't exist until like 200 years ago when they combined some other dogs. So I look at it as like genetic modification is sometimes good.
This one is about the lack of restaurant control. The question is, why isn't it illegal for restaurants to lie about what they're serving you? And is it that their lobby is that strong, or is that we are not having as enough vigilance at the state and local level?
It's a lack of vision. It's not a lobbying issue. Because a lot of these are mom and pop restaurants that have basically no clout in the political arena. It is that it's regulated at the state level, and it's never really been deemed important. And one of the incidents I talk about in the book is this huge grouper scandal. They call it the Gulf Coast grouper scandal of whatever year, I forget, 2005 or something, that happened in Florida. Floridians are mad for their grouper. Grouper is a wild-caught fish that's not farmed, that's very prolific on the Gulf Coast of Florida. There's a lot of local places specializing grouper, just like you have lobster shacks in Maine. And it became common knowledge through a Tampa Bay Times investigation that most of this grouper was not grouper. It was imported catfish, panga, and these things from Southeast Asia. And it caused Florida to basically redo its restaurant laws, now among the strictest in the country. And until that happens elsewhere, I wouldn't expect much change.
We see a lot of labeling for gluten-free, for example, gluten-free sugar. Do you have an opinion about gluten-free foods?
I do. and it's not... Gluten-free is something that has, in its own way, become kind of trendy. People who actually have celiac disease or gluten insensitivity are lucky in that they live in sort of now like this golden age of availability of gluten-free products. But they become so prolific, it's almost like diet, that people think it's got to be good for some other reason. And if you don't have a gluten intolerance, you don't need to be shopping for gluten-free products. And it's not whether or not you should eat gluten-free or you shouldn't. It goes to the labeling. And this is sort of a new hot-button issue. I wrote an op-ed about this for the Wall Street Journal. And it's a new thing called fear-based labeling, where manufacturers try to scare you into buying their product. And because the FDA regulates against positive claims, so you know they can't say, like, this is good for you, but they can scare you into thinking that their competitor's food is bad for you. And one of the ways to do that is to put on labels like gluten-free, even if the product could never have gluten in the first place, which a lot of these products don't. So there is, I mean, they said sugar. I've seen gluten-free water, bottled water. And the idea is like, oh, well, this one's gluten-free, this one's not. I might as well buy it. And it's not just the gluten-free. I mean, we talk about the GMOs. There's a company that's selling non-GMO salt. And I think it's well known that there's a little bit of a science and educational crisis in this country, but like, you don't have to go to many science classes in high school to learn that salt is a mineral and it doesn't have genes. And it cannot be genetically modified. But there's a lot of this, what's called fear-based labeling, which is just put things that could never, vegan, whatever it is, could never have been in the product on it, so that when it sits next to another product that doesn't say non-GMO, you'll buy it.
Okay, talking about fear, if we do buy San Marzano tomatoes, they are still packaged in metal containers that are reported to be extremely toxic. What is your opinion on this? Have you done any research, and do you have any conclusions about the packaging of good food?
I really have it on the cans, though, from stories I've done on the beverage industry, where there's a big trend now towards craft breweries and cider makers and even wineries now moving to cans instead of bottles. And for a long time, the presumption among beer drinkers were that cans were inferior, easier to transport and things, but didn't taste as good. And the beverage industry has basically redesigned the can, which has a coating on the inside so the beverage never comes in contact with the metal. And most people in the beer industry will tell you now that a can is a superior way to a bottle to buy your beer. And I don't know if that extends to San Marzano tomatoes, however. It's something I haven't looked into. But I do want to say that, you know, packaging definitely is important in some other things. And one of the examples I use in my book is if you go to the supermarket and you buy like a pound of ground turkey, right? It comes on a styrofoam tray covered in plastic, but it almost looks like it's inflated, you know, like the plastic is taut and kind of puffy. And that's called modified atmospheric packaging. And what the manufacturer does is when they seal up that package, they pump ethylene gas into it. And the gas is inert and harmless to us. But what it does is it prevents the meat from changing color as it spoils. And because all the meat sold in supermarkets in America has to have a use-by or sell-by date on it, the manufacturers say, well, people should read that label and not buy it if it's expired. The problem is people look at like a pound of hamburger and it's red. They don't always look at that date. And studies have shown that the staffers in the supermarket don't look at that date either. They look at the case, the meat is red, so they don't replace it. Consumer Reports did a study where in some supermarkets in America, something like half of the ground beef being sold was already past its expiration date. And I did a segment with Inside Edition in New York where they bought lamb that was packaged this way and put it under a time delay camera, took a second package and ripped it open and put it under a time delay camera at room temperature, shot these pieces of lamb for 2 weeks. And the one on the right was like covered in this horrible mound of green and white fungusy mold you would never touch. And the one on the left still looked like fresh lamb, and they're exactly the same. So packaging is important.
So if we're in the supermarket and we are looking at different packages, this next question says, what section of the grocery store is most prone to food fraud and why?
Whew, that's a good one. I would say the oil aisle. But it's really, you know, if you read Omnivore's Dilemma, which a lot of you probably have if you're into food, you know, he says shop the ends of the supermarket, the fresh fruits and vegetable case and the dairy case and skip everything in between. I think that's a little bit of an overgeneralization, and certainly there's problems in the fresh vegetable and fruit case and the dairy case as well.
Okay. And there's another big question, the last one. As a tea drinker, and I represent probably 90% of the people in here as tea drinkers, what's the story on tea? Can it be fraud? What's up with tea?
Tea does suffer from a lot of the same issues as ground coffee because unlike buying whole beans, there's not that much of an alternative. You can buy whole leaf tea and make, you know, rather than tea bags and make the tea yourself, but it's still hard to recognize it. But the studies have shown the problems are much bigger with herb tea than with traditional tea. Herb tea there's nothing you can do about it. The studies have shown that the fraud in herb tea reaches across all price points and brands, and again, it's like the oregano. It's most commonly cut with things like lawn clippings because any chopped up green matter you put in there, you expand your profit margin.
Wow. This has been an incredibly informative talk. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us today, Larry Olmsted.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. And please stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday will feature Elizabeth Marshall Thomas and Cy Montgomery on Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind.